This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What kind of reads are helping you out right now? Sometimes the very specific, very intentional language of poetry can slice right to the heart of what we're feeling, our distress, our anger, our pain, or other things that are coming up in the moment. We've been wanting to check in with Michigan writer and critic Molly Spencer. An accomplished poet, she is also the senior poetry editor for The Rumpus, a website for excellent writing of all kinds. She also teaches writing at the University of Michigan's Gerald Ford School of Public Policy. Molly, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thank you so much for having me.
How are you getting through all this?
Well, I'm trying to stick to my usual routines to get through all this. So that means a little bit of reading and writing every morning. And I also find that, oddly, domestic routines help center me. So I've been doing a lot of folding of linens and sweeping of floors.
We asked you to bring some poets that we may be less familiar with, but who are doing interesting work in the moment. Let's start with Ji Hwan Yoon. How did you get to know her writing?
So I got to know it simply because I try to pay attention to debut collections as they come out every year. And Ji Hwan Yoon's debut collection is called Some Are Always Hungry. And it won the Prairie Schooner Book Prize, which is a prize I keep my eye on because they always select such incredible collections. So this particular poet is in Ann Arbor now. We're lucky to have her here. She grew up in California, studied poetry in New York, and somehow ended up with us here in flyover country. Her collection, Some Are Always Hungry, came out this year, actually in 2020, from the University of Nebraska Press. She did a Fulbright research fellowship as part of writing this collection, which traces a family through time in the aftermath of both Japanese occupation of Korea and the Korean War that the United States was involved in.
You know, I have to say she is one of those poets who chooses to interact on Twitter. I'm always grateful for people who do choose to wade in. And it's been a great place to keep an eye on her online readings and other places. A lot of her work, as people might guess from her poetry collection title, is concerned with sustenance. Can you tell us about the threads that she works with, about the things that we consume and the spiritual sustenance that keeps us going? How do those threads entwine in her work?
So, yeah, one of the things I love about this book is that there is a lot of visceral imagery. And, you know, sometimes we use the word visceral figuratively to talk about things that we find very moving emotionally. But in this case, I'm being literal. There are a lot of bones in this book and flesh, lots of mouths and skin. So these poems make us look at war and what war does to the human body. They ask us to think about nourishment and how we get our nourishment and how that can be passed through generations, both in terms of trauma and in terms of joy. And of course, the body is also the site of desire and romantic love. So the way that the threads of those three kind of ways that we use and feed our bodies is really powerful in this collection.
Could you read to us?
I'd love to. I'm going to read a poem called Passage 1951. And it's this collection traces generations. So we have a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter. And as the collection unfolds, we kind of move through their lives. So this is set in the time of war, Passage 1951. Once I saw shrapnel cut a woman's head clean off like a halved pill bug. Her legs kept carrying her a while from this world into the next, and when she finally succumbed, the baby, strapped to her back, tumbled out like a squash during good harvest. The baby still lived, but no one stopped but to undress the mother, press her bared body into earth, take what they could for themselves. I did too, my siblings and I, a plague of locust on each new body that folded. We fought others off with disrobed hunger, all teeth and tremor. I feared we would never unwild ourselves. But this way, at least, we were fed. A few pouches of stolen grains or a strip of jerky, still damp with sweat. We grew to love the iron in death. My sister began to smile while looting bodies, and the sight of her put a freeze in me. It was only after seeing her I knew what my own mouth was doing.
Molly Spencer reading to us from the work of Ji-Hwan Yoon. She just cuts right through some of the, I think, some of people's expectations about what sustenance is supposed to be about.
Absolutely. I mean, this poem really shows us the desperation of war, but it also shows us some complicity, right? Complicity born of that desperation.
Yeah. There's another writer you brought to us, Sumitra Chakraborty, who's another one in Washtenaw County right now. She's a Zell visiting professor of poetry at the U of M. Had you met her before the lockdown started?
No, I had not. We had exchanged some texts. I was kind of welcoming her to town, and I did end up doing a reading with Sumitra. And so we definitely met over Zoom, which is a different way of meeting, and yet I was glad to know her that way. So yes, she's at the university teaching in the creative writing program and doing her scholarly work. This poet who I believe grew up on the East Coast, got her PhD from Emory, and now again is here with us in Ann Arbor.
She works in what I guess I want to call it, I guess I want to call a quasi-prose style. She's paying a lot of attention to the words on the page, though. What drew you to what she's doing?
So one of the things I admire most about Sumitra's work is her range. I mean, this is such a wide-ranging collection. We've got long, sprawling, elegiac poems, and we've got the small prose poems that you're referring to strung throughout the book. And then we have poems that are near fragments. There's a long poem called Windows that began as Sumitra's translations of Rilke, but then eventually morphed into their own form and her own words and became this poem of near fragments. So her range is just impressive. And I feel like behind every poem in this book is this sparkling intelligence. She combines the language and gestures of theory and literary tradition and art with these beautiful, lush poems. And also a clearly a poet with a lot of heart. So when I think of Sumitra's work, I think about just the sheer abundance of both pain and beauty and intelligence in her work.
Will you give us a taste of what she's doing?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem from late in the collection. It's called Simply O. And it's a bit of a variation on a series of poems in the book that are all titled O Spirit. And if you forgive me for being kind of a nerdy poet for just a minute, the gesture...
I'm here for that.
The gesture, the word O is a crying out. It's in poetry circles, we refer to it as apostrophe. And it's a crying out, often kind of to the divine. We hear it a lot in religious context, but also in poetry, it could be a crying out to any number of things. But in this poem, it is simply, oh, it is simply that crying out that is the title. Stars are not the end, but the beginning. A bird is to its throat as a promise is to its sharp edge. I wanted to make for you a sun shower. Instead, I have made for you a mortal thing. Writing is knowing how to cut. There is a space in my body that did not exist when I began this book. It is a window. When I next speak, I will do so through a window. Please leave the window unlatched. When I next speak, it will be with changed lips. I wonder what their color will be. Finally, she enlarges the figure to a grand scale and cuts off its head. So one of the things I love about this poem is that it refers to the act of writing, and it tells us something about the process of making art, that gesture at the end, which is actually a quote from another visual artist, that gesture of cutting off at the head as a gesture of completion to the making of a piece of art, in this case, a poem.
Sumita Chakraborty's debut collection, Arrow, came out in September of last year with Alice James Books. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Molly Spencer, a poet, critic, and a writing instructor at the University of Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. She's also the senior poetry editor for The Rumpus. Let's move it on to a poet that we're really excited about, Tommy Blunt, who lives in Detroit. He was a finalist for the recently awarded National Book Awards for the poetry category, wasn't he?
Yes, and I was just so thrilled to see that. Tommy is so great and so humble, actually. And to see his beautiful book on that list, I just was filled with joy for him.
Yeah. He's a very private person, but how do you see him interacting with the world through his work right now?
So Tommy, I feel a kinship with him because we both kind of came up as poets outside of the traditional academic setting of, you know, residential creative writing programs. He did study with Diane Wachowski at Michigan State, took a poetry class, and then was really active in the Detroit spoken word scene. And we have we're so lucky to have that, the spoken word poetry scene in Detroit available to us here. So he came up kind of, as I said, as a poetry outsider, eventually getting a low residency MFA from Warren Wilson, and then producing this beautiful book, Fantasia, for The Man in Blue, which came out from Four Way Books in 2020.
Let's do a reading first and then talk about what he's doing.
Great. Okay, I'm going to read one of the series of poems that are titled Fantasia for the Man in Blue. And these poems act as kind of a form of scaffolding or a spine for the book. Fantasia for the Man in Blue. You know that painting, right? Matisse's Icarus? No, not so much a body to speak of. A darker suggestion. An absence of a body. An outline. Surrounded in blue, that's you, what you were. I can see fitting the description if you were not denied a face. Arms perhaps tattooed with a lover's name, a mother's face, some evidence of having a life. And of your manhood, where is it? Either way, the blue has its way with you. It's constellation of small destructions all around you. Shell casings. No, not so much the shell, just the evidence of the shell. A bright wound where a heart can't possibly exist.
Wow. There's so much there about how Black men and also Black queer men, as Tommy Blunt is, you know, the space that they take up in the world, or the space that the world doesn't really let them take up, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things I love about this series of poems in the book is that they do interact with art, as many other poems in the book do. All kinds of art, really. Visual art, performance art. And the way that Tommy is able to bring both brutality and tenderness into this poem and many others in his book is just amazing to me.
This has been a very tough year for people in a lot of different disciplines because, like you say, it's been hard to focus.
Yes.
It's also been hard to try to access those systems of support that keep a lot of different artists going. Do you see people like Tommy and Sumita and Jihuan, you know, and really all poets, is there space for everyone to flourish in this time that we're going through? What's going on with the residencies and the grants that normally keep poets doing what they're doing?
Well, I know that some of the places that host residencies are doing virtual residencies. I'm not sure if people are starting to kind of plan again for in-person residencies now that we have a vaccine, I think all of us are kind of holding our breath, waiting to see, you know, when will we be able to literally go places with our art again? When will we be able to travel either for a residency or for readings? When will we be able to gather in a room of poets and readers of poetry again? I think we all miss that very much. But I also think that one of the gifts of this time, if we have to be in a time where we can't gather, you know, we have the internet, and for all of its kind of ills, one thing that the internet has done in the world of poetry is that it has connected poets who otherwise wouldn't be able to connect. And it has made space for poets that, you know, the kind of traditionally cultural system of poetry hadn't made space for before. And so we have a beautiful flowering of voices and subjects that poets are interacting with, and different ways of being poets in the world. And in fact, I believe, and I'm trying to remember the statistic, but I believe it was Ron Charles writing in the Washington Post and referring to a study that he had seen that the readership for poetry has increased a lot with the dawning of the poetry internet. And I know that for me as a poet, I did so much of my learning through the poetry internet because, like Tommy, I wasn't part of kind of a traditional academic enterprise.
Molly, could you say more about maybe how some of those systems and some of those networks have opened up? Is it because people have to interact online?
Well, I think the kind of the opening up and the flowering of that space happened well before the pandemic. And it just, basically what it did was it made poetry accessible to people who might not have known where to find it before. You know, I think of myself, I grew up in a little farming community in West Michigan. There was no bookstore. The closest one was an hour away. I didn't know that literary magazines existed until I went to college. And so, you know, there are communities and pockets of existence that prior to the internet reaching them, you would have had to work really hard to access poetry. Now you don't have to work hard. You just log on to Twitter or log on to Facebook or log on to the Poetry Foundation website or poets.org and sign up for their Poem a Day email. And it's kind of right there for the taking.
Molly Spencer, writing teacher at the University of Michigan Ford School of Public Policy and senior poetry editor at The Rumpus. Molly, take care.
Thanks so much, April.